Hello, everyone. This is Bob Baker. I'm the author of the Guerrilla Music Marketing Handbook and proprietor of a long-running website called TheBuzzFactor.com. I'd like to welcome you to what I know is going to be just an amazing call. This is actually the first in a series of three or four conference calls that I'll be doing to preview an event called the Indie Buzz Bootcamp. And this is a weekend music conference. It takes place June 20th through the 22nd in St. Louis, Missouri, which is my hometown here in the Midwest of the USA. And I'm describing this event as an independent music career development weekend where the focus will be on education and inspiration and interactivity between a room full of like-minded artists, managers, and music promoters. And my goal is to immerse attendees in 2.5 days of these ideas and tools and to help people who go to forge a new path with their music careers. And I'm really excited that I've got a great lineup of speakers, including Ariel Hyatt and Tom Jackson, Nancy Moran, John Taglieri, and, of course, I'll have my own share of stage time there as well, plus this guy that I happen to have on the line with me right now. I'm talking about Derek Sivers. He is the founder, the president, and the programmer of CD Baby and Host Baby. He's a well-known music entrepreneur who's done wonders for for independent artists all over the world. So it's with great pleasure that I say, Derek, thank you so much for being on the call.
Well, thanks, Bob. Yeah, it's kind of funny that Bob and I have known each other for, 15 years or something?
I think it's, it's at least 12 or 13, okay. But close to
long
it.
Long before CD Baby, yeah. Yeah, you're right, probably about 13, yeah. Long before CD Baby, I sent Bob my own album back in 95, 96.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, my memory's a little fuzzy, and I'm glad you brought that up because I'm trying to clarify it too. But as some people know, I used to publish a local music newspaper here in St. Louis. In fact, that's how I sort of got into publishing and journalism and writing to begin with. And I'm pretty sure, yeah, that the first connection was you were an independent artist back then, and you sent in your CD. And what was, you remember, like, what was the name of the band and the CD that you would have sent, if you can think back?
The band is called Hit Me, and the CD was called Greatest Hits Volume 17. That was my debut album. So I think I sent it to you, and I think I even took out a quarter-page ad in your magazine. It was the first time I'd ever advertised anywhere, and I think almost one of the last places I've ever advertised.
Right.
I haven't really advertised much in the last 12 years.
Well, in 96, that was, at that time, my first book had actually been out for 3 years. I had been a published author, but I was still kind of early in my career writing and speaking about music marketing. But I think 96 was when I released the early first edition of this Guerrilla Music Marketing Handbook that I guess has sort of taken on a life of its own. But I was still sort of finding my way with what sort of, you know, services and things to offer indie artists. And I did this thing actually that was separate from my local music magazine called the New Music Buzz Report. And it was something I sent to like radio stations and A&R people because they mattered then. and you ran an ad in that thing. And I remember, Hit Me, and you called the company, I think it was Hit Media or Hit Me or something related to that name, right?
Yeah, that was long ago.
and actually,
you know what? Funny, people who have been on CD Baby since the early days, the old checks that you used to get used to say it was from Hit Media Inc.
Oh.
And it's because when I created CD Baby, I'd already set up a corporation for my band. Long story, probably shouldn't have bothered. These days, maybe I would have just done an LLC or something simpler, you know. But I set up a corporation for my band, and so when I started CD Baby, it's like, oh, man, I don't want to start another corporation. That was a pain in the ass. That was expensive. So I just made CD Baby a DBA for the corporation that I already set up for my band. So really up until just a couple of years ago, CD Baby was just a DBA for Hit Media, Inc., same business I started, which took out an ad in your paper back in the mid-90s for my band.
Well, I've got to share one more quick story because I know there's a ton of things I want to ask you and people on the call want to ask you. But I remember when you ran one of those ads in that New Music Buzz Report thing that I was even using the word buzz back then before the buzz factor even existed. But I remember that's how we started having phone conversations like about the ad that you were running, and I think we had a connection because even back then we had this sort of similar philosophy, a kindred spirit about taking your career into your own hands and all that good stuff. And so it was really cool to have gone back that far. But I remember you were trying to decide on the headline of this ad, and I forgot what the other one was, but it was blah 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 or James Brown meets the Beatles. And I said, oh dude, it's obvious, James Brown meets the Beatles. It's definitely an eye catcher. And you ended up using that. And then years later, I heard you giving a workshop in Nashville where you were talking about how you used to promote your band with James Brown meets the Beatles. Sitting there going, yep. I helped him.
Exactly.
I was
totally.
Actually part of that history, you know.
So. Well, hey, you know, it's funny. Every now and then, especially when I was telling people about your event coming up, people would say, yeah, so who's this Bob Baker guy? And I'd say, oh, who's Bob Baker? Like, he's a young guy, but he's like the grandfather of this thing, man. Bob's been doing it for years and years and years before anybody else. So all this kind of, like, you know, helpful advice for musicians and guerrilla marketing and all that, like, that's my fault. You were doing it before anybody.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm still amazed.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad to be doing this official call. It's cool.
And especially thank you for calling me a young guy. I really that I'm really appreciative of. Let's talk about aren't you celebrating 10 years of CD Baby this year?
Yeah, well, I'm not currently celebrating while we speak. I stopped celebrating right before the phone call, and I'll start celebrating again right after the phone call.
Sounds
but,
good.
Yeah, CD Baby's 10 years old. I started it in March of 1998.
Oh, wow. So just a couple of months ago was the official 10-year anniversary. That, I mean, what an accomplishment. And I actually remember also back then I was sitting in the kitchen of the house where I lived at the time, and we were having one of our conversations, and you called me to get some feedback on this idea that you had about how you and I think a lot of people know the story about how you spent a lot of money, went through great effort to set up to be able to accept credit card orders for your own CD, and then friends started, you know, asking you, and I think it was around that time you were going, do you think this is something that, you know, bands would be interested in? And I remember going, sounds good.
But dude, you know what's funny is actually, for the first, like, 9 months I was doing it, nobody was interested in it. I think it's funny that for the first 9 months of CD Baby, it was free. It was just, I was really just doing it as a favor. I had no intention to make a single dollar off of it. In fact, I was even willing to do it as a loss, at a small loss. It's just like a favor to some friends. And then I was just kind of curious to see if anybody liked this idea at all. So I went off to this music conference in Vegas that doesn't exist anymore, but it was called the Edom Conference. So it was like one of those, like, CMJ, South by Southwest style conferences. Went off to the Edom Conference in Vegas, mostly for the sake of promoting my own band. But while I was there, I was like, hey, you know what? I'm doing this thing called CD Baby. I'm going to bring along some flyers. So I brought along some CD Baby flyers, and I was going around to every musician at the conference going, hey, you know, if you want, I'll sell your CD. It's totally free. I'll set you up for free, whatever. And people were just looking at me like, yeah, dude, I'll let you know.
Right.
And what's funny is that there was nowhere to sell your CD online those days. It's like Amazon didn't sell CDs. CD Now was the only game in town, and they were just a direct pipeline to the major label distribution. There was nowhere to sell your CD online. There was no PayPal. There was no eBay. Well, technically there was eBay, but, you know, people didn't go buy music there or whatever. It was like just Pez.
There was no PayPal, certainly, right?
You know, I started CD Baby like 2 years before PayPal launched. And it was just funny. Nobody really understood the concept. And so I'm sitting here offering to do it for free, and nobody took me up on it. But anyway, yeah, enough, you know, ancient history. We should get into some good stuff here.
But that's quite an accomplishment. And I know you have an about page at CD Baby that I've actually pulled up here. It seems these numbers are always changing, but I don't know if you have them in front of you. I can just read. I don't know how recent these are, but it says 231,000 plus artists now are represented at CD Baby. 4.3 million CDs sold online to customers. Over 76 million paid directly to artists. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that's my favorite number. You know, when everybody's talking about the decline of the music industry or the death of the CD, I just, you know, I can't help but wondering what world they're dialing in from, because when you're at CD Baby, it's just, you know, sales are up over, even physical CD sales are up 30% over last year.
Really?
Every single week we pay out just an average of almost $1 million a week paid out to musicians these days. And it's like just checks running directly to the musicians. And it's just, it's such a heartwarming feeling when anything else in the music industry gets you down. It's like, come work at CD Baby for a day, and you just see so many people buying music that they've never heard of before, from completely independent artists doing it themselves. All the money goes directly to the musicians. It's just like, I'm really kind of proud that it's like I really set up, accidentally set up a little utopia that seems to be immune to the woes of the rest of the music industry.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's been a godsend to indie artists. And, you know, whenever your name has come up over the years, or especially, you know, it's come up a lot with this boot camp event, and people are always praising you. I'm like, thank God he did that. And, you know, and he's God's gift to the independent artist. All this stuff. So I know you hate to have all these praises heaped upon you, but I'll go ahead and do it anyway. But yeah, that is cool, because quite often, you know, you hear the doom and gloom about the traditional music business. But to me, it's very similar to the economy. All these reports have been recession and people being laid off, but there's always, you know, slices of the economy. And I can say from my own situation, I'm not reeling from the recession, as I've sort of created I like to think of recession-proof little business. So it all depends, you know, I guess how you choose to look at the world, and whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, you know.
Exactly. You know, I just thought about that, you know, no matter what kind of recession we're in, or even imagine it gets twice as bad next year, there's always going to be like that little brand-new store that opens up in town that is doing, you know, a coffee shop in a completely different way that is just so cool and so popular. It sounds like the lamest little example, but right next door to my girlfriend's apartment, there's a place called Panera Bread. Have you heard of it?
Yeah, actually, they're in St. Louis. They're called St. Louis Bread Company, but outside of St. Louis, they're called Panera. So, yeah, there's some St. Louis roots there. Yeah.
So Panera Bread, I mean, I know they're probably like some huge chain, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're owned by McDonald's or something, but it actually, they've kind of outdone Starbucks as far as like making a place that's like free Wi-Fi, comfortable chairs, really just kind of cool to hang out at. And instead of just coffee, they have food. It's like we've gone down there a couple times and been really impressed with the food, just really impressed with the chocolate chip cookies. Oh my God, like the best chocolate chip cookie I've ever had. And it's so cool. It's like, you know what, new businesses are starting up all the time. And it's like, who cares what's going on in like the global world economy? It really doesn't affect what's going on your block that much. You know, maybe you'd be wrong to say it doesn't affect it at all, but there's always somebody like new starting something up. And I think this reflects back to bands that, you know, instead of bands, you could say artists, because just musicians in general. So what if, Mariah Carey is selling less CDs than she did last year, or Madonna's new tour isn't doing that well, and people are talking about the decline of so-and-so? It's because, you know, the Madonnas and the Mariah Careys are not doing as good as they used to. But, you know, down at the bottom, I often think about it like this. You know, if you've ever looked at one of those stock ticker pages, you know, where they draw a chart to show you, like, you know, how Apple stock is doing or how right. Microsoft stock is doing or something.
It's up, it's down, it's up, yeah.
Yeah. Now imagine, you know, imagine they're often tracking stocks that are up at, like, you know, $100 per share. And so they show you one of those comparative charts where they say, okay, here is Microsoft stock up at $100 a share. And then imagine down at the bottom of that chart, there's a little $1 stock that in the last 5 years has climbed from $1 to $5. That to all the financial media, that's like off the radar. It's not even worth talking about. They're going to talk about how Microsoft has fallen 10%. But to all of us down there who, you know, hold the $1 stock and it's become a $5 stock, that's huge. It's like a 500% gain. And I kind of feel that the independent music community in general is like that $1 stock, that most musicians I know are doing better than ever. There's like more opportunities than ever. So it's like, you know, so what? Up at the top, Mariah Carey might be moaning about something, but you know, down here, things are going really well. You compare it to 10 years ago when there was no place you could sell your CD online. There was no PayPal. There was no whatever, even before MP3.com, before MySpace. It's like only 10 years ago, there was like very, very little opportunity. You really just stuck to like playing at bars and selling your CDs off the stage, and that's it.
Right.
So we're so much farther along than we were 10 years ago. It's just amazing.
Absolutely. And also, I have this theory that I've just recently started talking about in some of my live workshops, where I talk about – I have this thing that I think that quite often people are inspired to go into the arts because of they've read – like they've seen someone who's kind of popular. Like a lot of people my age will – often claim when they saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, that was what said, you know, kind of sparked, the light bulb went off, and they said, I want to do that. Or they saw somebody big or popular, you know, in the mass culture that inspired them to pursue some line of work. So they asked themselves, well, I want to do that, and so their model for success is the superstar. So they said, well, to be successful, I got to be in all the record stores, I got to be on the radio, I got to be doing a big concert tour with and selling out stadiums and all this stuff. And so they just kind of automatically knee jerk go to pursue that definition of success when really, these days in particular, there's a whole range of definitions of success. There are people that are carving out their own little niches under the radar. Most people have never heard of them, but they're making a good living, having a great time. And that's why I'm encouraging people to do so much, is to redefine or to create their own definition of success, not just the one that they think maybe is what success looks like. But any thoughts on that?
I'm actually looking forward to getting those stories out there more. I was just talking about this with a friend a couple days ago, that I think there are lots of people that, like you just said, that are making a good living, or like bought a house with the money they made touring, or just selling CDs, and maybe you've never heard of them, but they're living a good, happy musician's life. And I kind of want to do more to get those stories out there, so I think I'm going to pretty publicly announce pretty soon kind of a success stories project, where I want to meet and interview and share the stories of these people, because for one, it's just inspiring, but for two, it can give really specific tips to many other musicians that can kind of, any of this stuff is repeatable. So
right.
What Gary Jules did to reach his success, it might apply exactly to your situation, but he did it in L.A., you can do it in North Carolina and have the same kind of result.
One of the speakers at the boot camp was a guy named John Taglieri, who I know is a friend of Ariel's, who you know well. And he's going to be one of the speakers. He lives in New Jersey. He's an independent artist. He's got a work ethic unlike anyone I've ever met. And he set a goal years ago to quit his day job and become a full-time artist. And he reached that goal a few years back. And yeah, I've done a number of calls and things with John. I'm just really he's actually one of the reasons I'm bringing him into the boot camp event in June, is because he's a living example of living exactly what we're talking about here.
So
you just sort of made the pre-announcement that you're going to be publicly. Is this sort of like announcing that you're going to be running? That you're soon going to announcement that you're running for like those politicians do. They announce that they're going to make the announcement.
No, I'm always working on something, so this is just like, it's, the idea is really just a few days old, and I just really want to kind of start collecting some success stories and sharing them, because I think it would be really helpful for everybody.
Cool. It's a political season, so I can't help but look at everything through that lens. So 10 years of CD Baby, we've already talked about. I mean, the massive shifts that have happened, but I don't know if there's anything else in that regard that you want to touch on.
Well, lots I would love to talk about there. So the kind of changes and shifts of the last 10 years. One of the coolest things I've noticed, a couple of them, is that the top sellers on CD Baby are not doing very mainstream music at all. And I had the most beautiful example happen over the last few years, that you may have heard of an artist named Regina Spektor,
mm-hmm.
who now is pretty famous and on Warner Brothers. She, for quite a few years, was just exclusive on CD Baby. She would just mail us her CDs herself. And the first few albums that she sent us were just kind of like normal, kind of arpeggiated piano, Tori Amos style girl with a piano. A little different than that, but if you had to compare it to something, you'd kind of go, it's kind of like Tori Amos, And they just weren't that attention-grabbing. They were good, but nothing that really stood out and twisted your head around and made you go, what did she just say? And then I guess I'm allowed to swear here. We're among, like little kids on the phone. But it, to me, it's kind of like something in her head just went, fuck it. And she started getting weird around her fourth album called Soviet Kitsch. And all of a sudden, her lyrics were like, she was singing about tonsils and molars and diving into your teeth and smelling your minty breath. And then on the next song, she, even though she's a piano player, she grabbed a drumstick with her right hand and with her left hand played piano, and with her right hand started just whacking the piano bench with a drumstick. and doing just these odd arrangements, and just all around, her music just got a lot kind of more daring and gutsy and weirder, and that's when people really started to pay attention to her. And all of a sudden, at CD Baby, her sales went up and up and up and up and up, and pretty soon she was selling like 10,000, then 20,000 copies of her album. Then she went on tour with the band The Strokes because, like, somebody, you know, was just so impressed with her album, and, you know, they sent it to a friend or whatever. She went on tour with The Strokes and did well enough that Warner Brothers signed her to a pretty big deal. And just a year later, I'm driving to work in Portland, and Robin will notice there's the train that goes, like, connects downtown to the airport. And the CD Baby office is right by the airport, so the highway that took me to the office goes right alongside that train. I'm driving on the highway. I look alongside the train, and the entire, like, six-car train is plastered with a giant, like, corporate-sponsored sticker saying, Regina Spektor, new album out, June 18th, Begin to Hope. I was like, oh, my God, that's, you know, that's you know, awesome. You've made it when your label buys out the whole train to advertise your album.
And she did it by going weird.
Yeah, she did it by going weird. And so, to me, this is a really... there's a really kind of supportive, what do you call it, enthusiastic, encouraging. To me, this is very encouraging for most artists, because I think, you know, even myself as a songwriter, you're often taught that the way to have success is to find that common thread, you know, to write the next Yesterday by Paul McCartney, find that common thread that everybody can relate to, you know, aim for the middle. And so I started thinking about this metaphor of the bullseye, like in an archery range.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's kind of like for a few decades of music history, up until, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, the only way you could have success as an artist was to hit the bullseye, which was like way on the other side of the archery range, like, you know, a 100 yards away, a little tiny 2-inch bullseye. And if you hit the bullseye, you were Peter Frampton. You were the Beatles. You were Kiss, whatever.
But it was hard to hit that bullseye, right? It was only small percentage of people would ever hit it, right?
Exactly. So every arrow shot at it, most of them all missed. Just occasionally there would be one superstar launched. But now it's like, imagine now metaphorically, that target is like 50 feet across, and it's only, you know, it's only 20 yards away from you now. It's actually pretty easy to hit. But the trick is, it's kind of like somebody cut out the middle, that there is no bullseye anymore. Because it's like there's no mainstream anymore. We're in this kind of YouTube culture right now where people don't just get their music from Walmart anymore. They can get it from everywhere. And so people that used to just listen to whatever was kind of fed to them by classic rock radio now can so easily explore the edges more. They're really not hanging out in the middle. It's like there's almost no mainstream anymore, and you'd be better off cranking up the intensity on your weirdness, you know, bringing out all of your quirks, having the confidence to do something daring and attention-getting and head-turning instead of going for, you know, the normal mainstream. That to me is one of the most encouraging, exciting changes I've seen happen in the last 10 years.
In fact, I think, I just read this. You have a relatively new blog that I was actually looking over prior to the call. I think it was from that post that where you described the target that I wrote down, remarkably unusual. Was that the same post?
Probably. Yeah.
As far as you know, where, instead of trying to be all things to all people, find the edge I think it's important to say that whatever that edge is or whatever that weirdness that you exude should be a natural extension of who you are as an artist. You shouldn't be something that you fake or find, you know.
And you know what's funny is that somebody pointed out to me once that even the most conservative legends were actually pretty extreme in their time. I mean, Frank Sinatra was a pretty extreme character, you know, Liza Minnelli, whatever. It's like, you know, these people that we think of as our grandparents' music now were pretty extreme for their time. I mean, you know, when Elvis first came out, et cetera. The Beatles' long haircut, you know. So I actually read an interesting interview with Eminem a few years ago where he said that his goal when writing his lyrics, his raps, his goal is to make you stop talking at the restaurant. So he always imagines his target audience as somebody a table of friends who's sitting there talking, and he's playing on the PA. I'm sorry, he's playing like on the PA system in the restaurant in the background, and he wants his lyrics to be so attention getting that you and your friends stop talking and say, "What did he just say?" And I thought that's a really good way of putting it. Like whether you're, you know, whether you're folk or whether you're world or whether you're pop or whether you're metal, whatever. It's like there's for everybody's style of music, there's a way to aim to turn people's heads, to really make them stop and go, huh? Instead of just having something that just kind of flows in one ear and out the other and then wonder why, you know, the world isn't paying more attention to your music.
Right.
So I think to me it's about having that confidence to be daring, to find something really new to say.
Yeah, our friend David Hooper from Nashville, I heard him once where he said there's he phrased it, there's no money in the middle, and what he meant is take one side or the other, and he referred to, you know, like there's Rush Limbaugh on one end and I don't know, Michael Moore or whoever on the other side.
That's a great comparison. You know. You can't, nobody makes money being a commentator that just evenly sees all sides. That's really funny.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you always going to have those bread and butter, I mean, those kind of all-American, you know, Katie Couric, I guess, is someone who doesn't offend a lot of people, especially when she was on the Today Show. And there are artists who, you know, even in the indie world, I one of my most watched YouTube videos was with this interview that I did with a guy named Terry Prince. He's a piano and a singer, and he plays, he does like busking or street performing on the Santa Monica Pier, which is where I met him and interviewed him. He's just got this great attitude. But he plays love songs. They're very accessible. And since all the tourists that congregate on the Santa Monica Pier, it's not a targeted audience. They're people from all walks of life. So actually it works to his advantage that he's got something that's sort of safe, you know. But he's a good singer, and he's sold like 15,000 CDs in a year and a half just playing like 10, I don't know, something crazy, like 10 hours a month or something on the Santa Monica Pier.
Is he a piano player?
He's a piano player and a singer. It's all like love ballad stuff. So that's pretty middle-of-the-road stuff, but he found a way to make that work for him. So there's exceptions to every rule, but for the most part, I agree with what you're saying. You need to pick a niche. And artists hate to pigeonhole themselves. They always go, oh, I'm so much more than this identity, but I think you and I both have a similar view of branding. I've heard you speak about this too. And I think, didn't you use the analogy of like if you're trying to break through a wall, what's going to get you through better, like a flat board that you push up against it? Didn't you talk about that one?
No, I like your twist on it. But wait, actually, before we go too far, I just pulled up Terry Prince on YouTube while we were talking.
Oh, didn't you?
I gave that guy $20 once.
Oh, did you? Oh, yeah, that's right. I think you're in that area sometimes, right?
Yeah. That's
you gave him $20. Bucks. Cool.
Well, you know what's funny? I always figured it's like it's so rare that you actually walk by a busking street musician. I mean, you just don't see them that often, unless it's really part of your daily commute. But to me, it's kind of like, whatever, you know, 15 or 20 times a year that I actually pass by a street musician. So every time I do, I always put like $20 in the hat. Just
freaks them out.
Their mind, because I feel it's like kind of like karma, kind of, you know, hey, I made my living by helping musicians, and I feel it's like I should give back. Anyway, so the metaphor you're talking about, I like a game of telephone, it turned into a wall and a plank. The metaphor I often use is that it's almost like your goal is to get attention, and it's like the world is like a big kind of foggy kind of, you know, vat of cream cheese of attention or whatever, and you can't cut through anything when you're well-rounded. Well-rounded just doesn't cut it.
Wow.
And so instead you get sharply defined. You define yourself as sharp as a knife. You just pick a single topic and focus on it so that everybody, or a single niche, so that everybody who thinks of that niche thinks of you. An example I often use is that band the Rosenbergs out of New York City, they owned the niche called power pop. They would just drive this everywhere. It's like their album title was something about power pop, and every time you talk to them, it just everything on their website said, the Rosenbergs, power pop from the Rosenbergs. Come here, the power pop show by the Rosenbergs. And their email address was like powerpop@AOL.com, and their, you know, et cetera. So they just really drove it home. So that any time you were telling your friends about the Rosenbergs, there was no ambiguity about how would you describe it. Because, you know, sometimes you're trying to tell your friend about a band that you heard. You went and see a show on a Thursday night, and it was good. And friends, oh, really? How were they? And you go, oh, it was kind of, I don't know. It was good. You should check them out sometime. You know, it's like, oh, you kind of blew it.
Right.
If you didn't have words to tell them why it was good. So the Rosenbergs, by really driving home this power pop niche, made it so that, you know, anytime you told your friends about the Rosenbergs, you'd say it's power pop. You know? And I thought that's the example I made with my James Brown and the Beatles, is that I got such good feedback after a while from using that comparison to describe my own music, I just started using it everywhere. So anytime during the day, you often run into people on the street that, you know, see the guitar on your shoulder and they go, oh, you're a musician. What kind of music do you do?
The age-old question.
And, you know,
yeah.
Most musicians freeze up at that question and say, kind of all, you know, kind of rock, jazz, pop, you know, samba, metal, kind of classical, kind of, you know, jazz, you know, rock swing. You just got to check it out, you know. We're playing next Thursday night down on Route 17 at 11 p.m. You should come check out the band. And the person kind of goes, okay, yeah, maybe. But to me, it's like you really just kind of missed your chance to tell them why they should pay attention to you, like make them curious.
Right.
To me, that when somebody asks you, what kind of music do you do, they are not asking you to justify your existence on Earth. They just want you to make them more curious. So all you need are just a few simple words to make them curious to hear more. And, you know, I learned this by experience. For years, I would just describe my music as, oh, it's kind of pop funky, whatever. And nobody knows what pop funky means. You know, I did, but nobody else seemed to. And as soon as I started saying, it's a cross between James Brown and the Beatles, you would watch people's eyes when you would say that.
Yeah.
They'd say, what kind of music do you do? Say, a cross between James Brown and the Beatles. And they do that thing where they kind of go, huh? They look up to the right. They look down. They go, dude, I got to hear that. And you go, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Here's a copy. And you've done it. It's like that's all you needed to do. You don't need to justify every note of music you're ever going to play or every song in your set list. Just give them a few words to make them curious to hear you and then shut up and tell them how to hear you.
Right.
That was the hardest lesson and one of the best lessons I learned. But, sorry, coming back to the well-defined sharp thing, what I love is that some of the best examples I've seen are artists who still use the album as a great way to target on a per-album basis. So Paul Simon is one of the best examples of this. He's had this giant, you know, 40-year-long career, but every album he does is sharply focused on a niche. So, you know, Bridge Over Troubled Water was this kind of like, you know, folk gospel, like kind of like folk with little gospel spiritual influence. Next, and I forget the name of his album that had like, oh well. Then he did this album that was like a straight up Paul Simon doing gospel. Then of course he went to South Africa and did his Graceland album. Then he went to Brazil and he did the next one, the Rhythm of the Saints album. Then most recently, like a year and a half ago, he did a really interesting album with him and Brian Eno, which is kind of full of Brian Eno's kind of interesting technological approach to production. And so now that was a niche. So there's somebody who can have a broad career, but yet each album is a niche. And David Bowie, of course, would change his whole identity for every album. You know, now I am Ziggy Stardust. Now I am the Thin White Duke. Now I am postmodern. Now I am, you know, now let's dance.
Exactly. And I've quoted you, too, because I've seen you write about this before, and you've talked about also tapping into like uses and themes, and I don't know if you use these specific examples, but like there are CDs out like music for yoga, music for meditation. If you can have a well-defined, you know, if you know how your people will use your CD, they'll be searching for those types of things as opposed to a CD that's called mellow piano sounds or something, which
exactly.
Might
exactly,
you know.
Yeah, and in fact, I know an instrumental musician. His name is escaping me right now, but he's on CD Baby. What he does is he's kind of got about 30 songs, instrumentals that he's written. He kind of keeps repackaging them with different themes. So, like, take, you know, 11 of those 30 songs and say music for meditation. Then he'll take, like, kind of some of those same 11 and maybe a few others, and he'll say music for massage. And he'll take some of those 11 and a few others and he'll say music for yoga. And just change the packaging, change the market, And then with each one, he kind of sends it off to different places for review. We're trying to get it to, you know, be placed on counters at retail outlets. And yet having a focus like that, but even without being so specific, and there's an interesting example. One of the first top sellers on CD Baby was this woman, Eileen Quinn, who is a full-time sailor from Nova Scotia. So every year she sails all around the world, and once a year she pulls in a dock and she makes a record. But her life is really sailing, and she's a musician. But she's actually a really good musician, except that all of her songs are about sailing. So, you know, when this album first came in, it's like there's a picture of her on a boat, of course, and it says Songs for Sailors. And all the song titles are, you know, Pulling in the Sheets and the West Winds and the Key Largo and the Yo-Ho-Ho. And you'd think, yeah, okay, she'll sell like 6 copies of this. But one day we started getting orders. It's like we sold like 200 or 300 in one day. And when I looked at the notes on the orders to find out where did you hear of this artist, everybody was saying, like, Boat US Magazine or Sailing Magazine. And it turns out that all of these sailing magazines were writing articles about her because there was more of a human interest story. Or more importantly, the music media is already overloaded. You know, whatever, 500 new albums come out each day. So you send your album off to CMJ or Spin, and they kind of, you know, might give you a paragraph. But, hey, big deal. Somebody released a new album. But now if you get out of the music media and into places that don't ordinarily write about music, such as sailing magazines, the tone of the story, Bob, was so funny. It was like, and there's this woman, Eileen Quinn, who's a full-time sailor, and believe it or not, she is recording and releasing her own music. Yes, that's right. You heard it. She is putting out CDs by herself.
Her own.
With no record label. Readers, I don't know if you can believe this, but it's true. And you can order her CD online just by going to cdbaby.com. And they put our 800 number at the end of the article, which is great because I got to talk to people calling in who would like be calling in from a dock in New Zealand somewhere saying, oh, I'm calling to get the new Eileen Quinn album. And, oh, that's great. Now she's making her own music. Fantastic.
Nice accent.
Thanks. but you know what I mean? It's
yeah.
Like, that's a novel story. The fact that you're a full-time musician or putting out your own music can be a completely fascinating novel story to people that haven't heard it much. So I often advise musicians to kind of find an angle that isn't just like, hey, check out my words and music. They're really good. You know, and find a different angle to jump on. And
absolutely.
Yeah, it
seems to defy logic. It's really hard for artists to grasp this, but yeah, by narrowing your focus and being appealing to a smaller crowd, you actually make a smaller connection with your core audience, and you open up a lot more doors and opportunities that you just wouldn't have by being a more generic artist or CD or whatever. I know people are probably itching to ask some questions of you, so I'm gonna let people know how they can pop in and ask us or ask you something. But real quick, since this is a preview for the boot camp, I just want to mention real quickly again that this is a preview call for the Indie Buzz Boot Camp. It's coming up June 20th to the 22nd in St. Louis. It's a Friday evening through mid to late Sunday afternoon of that third weekend in June. Now, Derek, I know I seem to be speaking at a lot more music conferences, but I know you've attended and spoken at many of these things over many conferences over the years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I have too, and I've been to some really good ones. I've been to some bad ones, some great ones, some not so good ones. But I always thought that there was a better way, because the typical format for these things is usually, and most of these things are based on sort of like the South by Southwest model, where the focus of the thing is the showcases, and typically it was, you know, being able to come in and hobnob with industry people and A&R people who were scouting all the bands that were playing there. And then as a sideline to that, since all these industry people were in town, they would throw together these panels and you know, some of the musicians would attend them, but usually they were just there to try to get their demo into the hands of some big shot.
Mm-hmm.
But I always thought there was a better way, and in other industries there are real estate and self-development and so on. There are workshops that are just there for the educational component of it. It doesn't have all these distractions, and that's really the model that I wanted to go with with the boot camp. So you won't see any panels. There won't be any tables on the stage. No lineup of five or six people sitting at a table veering off on a thousand different tangents. I handpicked some solo speakers of people that I know and trust, like yourself, to come in and deliver. And I know just not long ago in a phone call I shared sort of this vision with you, and you had some positive response to it. And any thoughts on the format as I've described it to you for the boot camp?
No, I think it's great. You know, it's the thing about showcases, God, I mean, South by Southwest is just kind of a why bother? I mean, I think, isn't it something like every night there are over 100 bands playing within five blocks or something? And it's just, for you to be yet another, you know, to me this is kind of like a core philosophy of any kind of business. You never just want to be yet another one of the masses doing the same thing as everybody else. And so much so that I've actually told my company, told CD Baby to stop going to these conferences completely, even as a company, because they were still, my guys doing business development or whatever, that were always trying to wrangle new deals with partner companies that we could help get everybody's music to, they kept thinking that, you know, hey, we're going to send eight people down to South by Southwest, we're going to get a big booth, and it's going to be great. But no, the truth is, like, people go down South by Southwest and you're just completely overloaded with too many bands, right, too many companies promoting their stuff, and you leave there kind of just like going, oh, holding your head, and you go home and you have this giant, oh, and even the idea of handing somebody a CD at those things. Everybody comes home with this massive, like, garbage bag full of crap that they got at the conference, or the real jaded ones honestly just leave it in their hotel room. They just, like, they have this massive bag full of stuff. Right. They leave it in their room and fly home.
Or toss it in the trash can. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I've just decided that you always want to stand out. So, you know what? If there is some company like Yahoo or whatever that we want to have better relations with, the time to do it is not, you know, being their 38th meeting that weekend at South by Southwest, but fly to Santa Monica, California, and have a one-on-one meeting with them. It's only a little bit more expensive, but it's like 100 times more effective to catch them in their office on a Wednesday afternoon where you are the only person meeting with them that day.
Right.
And you have a one-on-one, and you really get their stuff. And so with musicians, I think, the way to do it then would, if you do find yourself already at one of these conferences, it's too late. I'm not talking about yours, but these showcase-type ones. Then it's all about the follow-up, because I can tell you guys that for every 100 people that gave me their CD at a conference, I think only one out of 100 ever, like, followed up to ask what I thought about it, or give, you know, follow-up questions or whatever.
Right.
So it's all about the follow-up, because nobody's going to remember you from that conference. It's always about the communication afterwards. So all of this coming back to, when you told me about your event coming up, I was just psyched that, to me, you kind of took the best. You are kind of creating what if you didn't do it, I would.
Well, cool.
That's exactly what I think.
I beat you to it. All right.
Yeah, I'm glad you did.
Yeah, you're going to be sitting in your kitchen. You were sitting in your kitchen when I told you about my concept for something, and we'll see if it's still around in 10 years, though.
Yeah, I think what you're doing is the most useful, because it's all about the education. You know? I mean, there's the networking is so different for everybody, you know. I mean, you could bring 100 music executives, and it still wouldn't be, you know, there's like 10,000 out there that people have the chance of meeting. So instead it's about kind of the education and the tools, so that everybody can then go home and then on Monday morning use what they learned as it applies to them specifically.
Absolutely.
And contact the people, whether it's like a children's music TV producer in Florida, or if it's somebody doing instrumental soundtracks in Minneapolis, they can contact the people that are appropriate to them, instead of just trying to contact the same 20 jaded A&R guys showing up.
Exactly.
You know, anyway, yes.
Well, obviously, yeah, I've been in the business of writing and speaking about music marketing, and also there's a strong self-empowerment message. So I'm all about delivering as much value and giving people the information and the motivation that they need. So when I've attended these things as a speaker and then as an attendee attending other panels, I've always was left feeling a little hollow, like people didn't get, you know, all that they could have. So anyway, I've developed this event for people that are serious about the educational aspect. We're going to have fun there. There's going to be a lot of interactivity. You're not going to be a passive audience member just watching somebody speak. I'm encouraging all my speakers, including you, Derek, to interact with the audience and give them things to do and exercises, and there's going to be a lot of networking opportunities. There'll be a little bit of performance. There's going to be a Saturday night dinner with a songwriter's showcase and an open mic, but it's going to be sort of a sideline to the real reason that everyone's there, is to learn and grow and meet each other. And so, I'm really excited about this. And I know we're getting late into the call and still haven't let anybody jump in with some Q&A. So here's what you need to do. If you'd like to ask Derek a question, you can hit the number 6 on your touch tone pad, and that should unmute you alone. And you can pop in and ask a question. And when you're done, all I ask is that you hit 6 again to mute yourself so we keep the line clear. But if anyone is eager to jump in, hit 6 and go ahead and state your name and ask a question. Do we have any takers?
Hi.
Hello,
Derek?
Who's this?
Hi. This is Maddie from Brooklyn. How are you?
Great.
Cool. I wanted to ask you what your thoughts were on digital-only releases.
Mixed thoughts. The only reason I can think of to do them is if you're kind of either completely broke or have so little money that you just can't afford a few hundred dollars to press up a CD. The reason is that they're right now still the kind of the people that are opening their wallets to buy digital music online through iTunes, et cetera, are still only like 10 or 15% of the market. So the question that we often ask people who, you know, ask that to customer service or something, we say, well, are you really at a point in your career where you're willing to cut off 85% of your potential audience? And if so, hey, congrats. Go digital only. Good on you. But otherwise, I still think it's smart to do both. I mean, we're really in a hybrid time right now where some early adopters with broadband connections and fast computers and iPods and the wherewithal to kind of use that as a primary way of getting music, yes, those people like to buy digital files and put it on their iPod or whatever. But there's, you know, millions and billions of people out there that the CD is it for them. That's what they have in their car. That's how they get their music. That's what they want. And if you don't make that available, then it's kind of like, you're just cutting off people who otherwise would be glad to pay you for your music. So we always just advise people to do both. Unless you're really just like, you only have $75 to your name, you recorded a brilliant song yesterday, hey, you know, put the song up on iTunes and you can sell some. And that's fine. But, you know, I still think it's best to do both if you've got something you believe in.
Cool. And I ask if you're not asking a question, to please keep yourself muted so we can keep the line clear. I've got a little feedback or echo going on here, so somebody probably has a speakerphone on or something. But thanks a lot. Anyone else want to hit 6 and unmute themselves and ask a question? Jump right in.
Eric, this is Peter from Austin. Yeah, hi.
Hey, Peter.
I'm hearing the echo.
Yeah, I'm not sure. If someone knows that they have a line open, please hit 6 and mute yourself. Otherwise, But go ahead. Let's do our best to make it through it.
All right. I'll do my best here.
Okay.
I'm a bass player, but more to the point, I'm starting a management company with a colleague here in Boston. And you've been talking a lot on this call to the do-it-yourself musician, and that's awesome. The question I continually ask myself and ask the people that I talk to is, what does the independent musician want the manager to do for them in this? There's a lot of options open that you talked about. So what is it? What is the role that the artist wants me or my colleague or anybody to play for them?
Hmm. The unfortunately real answer is that everybody wants something different. it's funny, man. My girlfriend's a musician. She's in 3 different bands, and she is she's that total go-getter personality type. She likes taking care of the business. She wants to create the LLC herself. She wants to pick up the phone and book some things. So if she was working with a manager, she would be expecting more like inside connections, like deeper relationships to more straight up executive types at companies that could create some other things. She wouldn't need somebody to handle, you know, booking some club. She wants to do that herself. But, you know, other musicians, musicians can often be notoriously introverted, and which is great, you know, I mean, because that's where so much, you know, musical development comes, from those hours you spend by yourself in a room, and it's a certain personality type that enjoys doing that. And it's usually not the same personality type that, you know, really wants to pick up the phone and do a bunch of bookings or whatever. So that type of person might need a manager to really kind of take care of everything. But I think universally, the greatest value you could add to all of your clients is by being able to do that kind of more like deeper strategic executive-to-executive kind of meetings, you know, where you're the one that's going into somebody who's a straight-up suit, who's a VP of programming at a so-and-so TV station, and you want to talk to them about how, you know, this artist could help promote so-and-so. You know, kind of talking in straight-up business terms objectively in a way that an artist really, almost nobody can talk about their own music that objectively. And so I think all artists would be hoping a manager would do that. And in fact, you know, I mean, I think my own personal regret about my own artist career, looking back, I was so kind of, I was so enterprising. I was definitely this kind of like DIY, guerrilla, kind of do it all myself kind of guy. And I did really pretty well. I mean, I bought a house with the money I made touring. I haven't had a day job since 1992. I quit my job in 1992, and I've been a full-time musician ever since, until CD Baby started taking over my life. But, looking back, the biggest regret was I was spending all of my time booking gigs, getting press, doing all that kind of do-it-yourself stuff, and I had nobody that was, like, working the inside of the industry. So even that Regina Spektor story I told earlier, where her music was getting weirder and weirder and people were paying more attention, she had somebody on – I guess she had a manager who, like, knew somebody at Sire Records, who knew somebody that was the producer of The Strokes that got it to so-and-so, who was able to get it to this person who helps them make the decision to ask her to be their opening act on tour, which is the thing that really kind of broke her open. So I think it's, yeah, those kind of deeper relationships, that real kind of insider industry stuff. If you focus 100% on that, then you can have interns and assistants take care of the other things like booking gigs and uploading music to websites and getting some press and things like that.
Yeah, I would concur with that. I would say that I think it's important to point out that just because you're an indie artist and going in DIY route does not mean working in a vacuum and working alone. You definitely partner up with people, and you definitely, yeah, you can, there's tons, you never really succeed on your own. You need primarily the help of fans, but certainly other people who can help you reach fans.
Yeah.
I think there's an evolution that takes place. I always encourage every artist to do as much as they can on their own early on in their career, if nothing else, just to learn the ropes and to become an educated entrepreneur, so you know what's involved in these different things, and then you'll be a little more educated to, when you do hand that over to someone else who you delegate it to, you'll know what they go through and what's involved in it.
Yeah, it's like, I think about it more like, yeah, do it yourself a little bit, but not too much. At a certain point, you have to just hand it over to somebody else, or, you know, I often think of, you know, Bob, think of how many booking agents or publicists you've met that used to be in a band, but they were like the drummer who really enjoyed booking gigs, and pretty soon they enjoyed booking gigs so much that they just found a different drummer and became the booking agent. You know, because,
right.
I mean, at a certain point, that's what happened with me with CD Baby. At a certain point, I realized, you know what? There are plenty of people who can write a song better than me, who can put on a better show than me, but there's nobody who can do CD Baby better than me, and
right.
this is my calling. So I'm going to do this, and I kind of, for the first time in 10 years, started turning down gigs and spending more time doing CD Baby than I was my own music, and I was quite happy with it. It felt good to me. So, yeah, everybody's got their own kind of
right.
You got to know when to stop with the do-it-yourself. I like to think of it as decide it yourself, not do it all yourself.
Ah, yes. Good.
Hi, this is Mr. Billy.
Hey, Mr. Billy, you're on with Jarek.
What's your question? Just to chime in on that, you know, I've totally run out of time to work in, to work on the career, I took a different route. I really developed the street team to the max, and which is interesting because my audience is like, you know, 8 or 9 years old, but I find that the parents, we got like all these soccer moms and stay-at-home moms and dads, and I just rallied them all to get me 10,000 email addresses for libraries to sell my new CD to libraries, you know? So I rely a lot on unpaid people, but I like your thoughts on the street teams and the, you know, the volunteer people as opposed to paying, you know, for a staff and stuff if you're an independent artist.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that, Derek? On developing a street team for children's artists.
No, I think it's cool. I don't have anything to add to that.
Well, one of the reasons I call my website The Buzz Factor is because it's that term you heard a lot about the band having the buzz factor. It's when people are talking about you, and ideally that's the way you want your music to spread. It isn't about, in fact, my friend Scott Ginsburg, he's a guy you may have heard of him. He wears a name tag 24/7. There's a website called
Hello. I haven't heard of him.
Oh, you haven't? He's been all over the media. He's a friend here, lives in St. Louis, and he's a speaker talking about approachability and how to make a name for yourself. But he has a question that was brilliant. He says, would you rather that people hear from you or about you? It's a lot more powerful for them to hear about you than just audit this only from you repeatedly, like if you got, you know, on your mailing list. So you definitely want, and I know, Derek, you're a fan of Seth Godin. I know you've quoted him a number of times, right?
Yeah.
And there was something that in his book, All Marketers Are Liars, that this really, it was like one short part that this really set my mind racing. It's a very small part of the book, but he talked about the four reasons that like marketing campaigns fail. Number one was people didn't notice it. Number two is they noticed it but didn't try it. Three was they tried it but didn't like it. And four was they liked it but not enough to tell anyone else about it. And so I turned that around into more of a positive spin, and basically I actually put this in my Berkeley Music Marketing 101 course that I developed last year, where basically you have four opportunities, because most people are always saying, I got to get my name out there and how do I get noticed, but that's really the first part of the equation. You got to first get noticed, then you got to have people notice you enough to sample your music, then hopefully create music that they like, and then like well enough to pass on. So there's like four different, you know, levels that you got to think about. Maybe this is getting a little too detailed, but to me it was just fascinating to think about all the opportunities that you have to either seize an opportunity or blow it. You know?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's brilliant. It's you know, it's so much to me of marketing comes down to one thing, that it's just thinking of your music from the other person's point of view. And it's so weird when I hear people say, oh, well, I don't have any money to do the marketing, as if marketing was just buying ads. But marketing has nothing to do with buying ads. To me, marketing is nothing more than just thinking of what you do from the other person's point of view and acting upon that, which really just, even just the way that you talk to people is marketing. The way that you design your website to make it easy for them to forward something to a friend, that's marketing. It's like, it really doesn't cost anything.
Right, and I talk a lot about, even when it comes to like communicating with the press, I'll hammer home about how it's important to keep the journalist interest in mind, and how you think about it from their point of view and what you can do to help them. And sure enough, you know, 9 times out of 10, when somebody writes a pitch letter or something, it's all about, hi, my name is, my band is, my art, we have a CD coming out, we need this, we need that. It has nothing, and they've totally missed the point of looking at it from their point of view. I think people make that mistake over and over.
Ask a new question.
This is my statement and my question. My statement is, I used to be in the street life as a drug dealer and a pimp, and then God came into my life and, like, he showed me a lot of miracles, and I speak about that in my music. So my question is, how should I market my music? Should I market my music for the streets, or should I market my music for, like, church people?
Good one. Well, it depends. As you've been doing your stuff so far, who seems more receptive to it?
Both sides. fall in between of a Tupac. See, Tupac, he spoke about street life, and if you listen to some of his songs, he spoke a lot about God. And that's how my music is. My name is Street Spirit, and it's like I have four songs that are street, and I have six songs that are gospel. And I start off in the street life as a progression to where my life is now. So I go from one extreme to the next.
Right. You know what? How did you call them? The people that kind of were now off the street? Is that what you said?
No, street spirit.
You talked about the two different types of people, like those that are still kind of on the street and those who...
Like street, okay.
In church or something?
Let's say, before I used to be in the street life, I used to sell drugs, I used to be a pimp, and then one day God rained on me within 3 seconds of asking him to rain on me. I was in Las Vegas when that happened, in the desert, in the summertime, August 25th, 2000, the day I got married. And since that day, God has continually showed me things that have let me know that he's real. I seen a coin fall off the sky, and then I would tell my family about this, and then I got checked into a mental institution for an evaluation September 10th of 2001. I woke up in the morning, and the airplane was going through the World Trade Center. As I saw it, the plane hit the building and kept flying through it. It didn't crash. There was plenty of room on the TV to show the airplane going down, but it stayed up as if it just flew through it as if it was invincible.
Well, I think it seems to me that it sounds like you might have to do both. You know what I mean? When you talk about, like, should I talk to people in the church or should I talk to people on the street?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. He's got two potential audiences there that may be appealing to both. And as you get your music out there, that Terry Prince video that I mentioned, the guy in the Santa Monica Pier, he has this, mm-hmm. this great attitude where your job is just to show up and deliver your music to whoever, you know. He says, set the table and the hungry will eat. He's a little bit like a preacher himself. So I think just by being overly consumed with how you should market it and demographics and all this, just get your music out there and you'll notice who is attracted to it, and that will inform you about, you know, where to focus your efforts in the future. If you're still early on in it, it's probably too early to be slicing and dicing it too much, but obviously this is a very personal thing for you, and, you know, that's probably the best way to approach music.
But, you know, one of the top sellers on CD Baby is this guy, just got his name right now. David M. Bailey. David M. Bailey, about 8 years ago, he's a lawyer who was told he had brain cancer and would be dead in a few months. And he immediately quit his job and he said, you know what, I've always wanted to make an album. I can't die without making an album. And he quickly, in 2 months, recorded an album of his original songs. And then he didn't die yet. And he still had brain cancer, whatever. He kind of had some operations, whatever. He was in remission. He made a second album, and then he beat brain cancer. Apparently, it's gone. You know, the surgery was successful or whatever, and they were able to stop it. So he never went back to his life as a lawyer. He spends his full time now. Sounds like almost, you know, a similar kind of angle to yours, that now he really wants to talk to everybody who either has brain cancer already or has beat it. And both sides really kind of relate to his story. And I got to tell you, when people buy his album at CD Baby, they don't just buy his album. He has seven albums now. Almost everybody buys all seven because he's touched them so deeply. It's more than just like, oh, that was a good song. It's like, oh, my God, I want to have everything this guy has done. So I think you're on the right path. You know, just find people that are really passionate about what you're talking about and be as passionate as you are, and you'll definitely speak to them more than the people that are kind of treading lightly.
Absolutely. Thanks.
And now we're in talks with labels. I've gotten the press, Music Connection, Scope Magazine. I'm on Six College Radio Station, and right now we're speaking with Def Jam, Aftermath, Shady, and labels like that. And my thing is, if it does fall through, do I give them a single that's like a street single and then follow up with where I'm at now, or do I just come out with the gospel side right now, and then hopefully they won't be offended when they hear the other music that's up there.
You know what? The any other company that wants to put out your music that's not you, they're always going to have their own opinions about how they want to do it. So if you believe in them and they tell you their plans and you think it's a good plan, just let them run with it. You know, again, another situation that my girlfriend, who's also a musician, is in is she's also doing children's music, and she's just been approached by this company that's like a pretty big company, and they have their own idea for how this could be a TV show full of characters or whatever. And for the most part, she's just going, hey, cool, if that's your vision and it uses my music, go for it. So I don't think you have to worry about that stuff. They'll kind of present you with their ideas and run with it.
Yeah, cool. Well, thanks a lot for the call. I'm going to make a request. If anyone is already like a registered attendee of the boot camp, if you're listening and if you would mind here in six, I wouldn't mind asking having you pop in, and I might ask you a question. But if you're already registered to come, hit six and pop in here. Otherwise, we'll just go on with see if there's anyone else who wants to.
Hey, Bob, it's Rockin' Robin.
Rockin' Robin. How are
you? I wanted to ask you what y'all think of Taxi.
What do we think of Taxi?
Yeah, you know, the online music.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Taxi is, for one, Taxi is legitimate. I know some people think that they're, or kind of wonder if it's a total scam, total ripoff. Because, you know, if any of you have ever sent in your copyright form to the Library of Congress to get a copyright, almost everybody gets a letter in the mail afterwards from this scam company in Hollywood saying that they're going to, not Taxi, but like I forget what they're called, Rainbow or something, that says, hey, we'll record your song for only a few $100. We'll get you signed. So Taxi is not a scam company. They're a legitimate way to get your music placed into companies that are looking for music, especially kind of background music. You know, when their sports shows need to have music playing in the background, if they're showing the cars going around the loop or ads or whatever. Occasionally, they'll get calls from hit artists who don't write their own song. If they're saying, "Hey, we're doing a new album by whatever." Underwood, and you know, we're looking for songs for that. But for the most part, the people I've met who've had the best success with Taxi are the ones doing things like instrumental music that can be used in a lots of commercial situations. The problem, I think, with Taxi is mainly in their advertising. That when you see their ads in a music magazine, it's like, hey, I called Taxi on Tuesday, and by Thursday, I was signed with a number one hit. You know, it's like they take the one or two kind of weird, random, fluke success stories that they've had where somebody had like a number one hit single because of Taxi, and they use that in their advertising so much, which is, on one hand, you could call it smart advertising. It gets a bunch of people interested, but I think it also gets a lot of people disappointed because it's really not representative. It's kind of like the getting hit by lightning kind of scenario.
Yeah,
so,
I know what you mean. They sent me a thing for a free review of one song, so I did it, and they gave us really high marks, but I always kind of felt like, yeah, that it was more for that sort of kind of music, that genre, that background kind of thing. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, their song critiques, I know a lot of people who are, say that work in Los Angeles in the film industry, or like the, I'm sorry, not the film, but like the people that choose songs for movies, or they work at record labels. And they're all the ones doing the song critiques at night for Taxi. Like, they'll drive home from work, and on the way home from work, they stop off at Taxi for 2 hours and sit there and listen to songs and give them some ratings. So it's also a good way that if you're a very beginning songwriter and you've written, say, your first 10 or 20 songs and you really want to get some feedback from a total stranger that isn't just your family or friends, Taxi can be a good way to get some good neutral feedback on your songs if you want kind of outside industry feedback. But then you have to be aware that, you know, if they were to have heard a Nirvana song, they never would have named it as a hit or whatever. You know, that you're probably going to get people telling you how to write a very mainstream top 40 song, which, as we mentioned earlier, might have no audience these days. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's very wise advice. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you very much for giving us a place to sell our CDs. It's great.
Anytime.
I have a question.
Go ahead. Who just said they had a question?
Doug in Nashville.
Oh, cool. What's shoot?
Well, I'd like to thank both you and Bob, first of all, from the Blind Contingency over here in Nashville. Well, thank you, Derek, and please thank your people for always being there for us when we need help, extra help because of the lack of software we're dealing with. But my question is about the copyright. We as indie that own our copyrights, there's so many different outlets of stream of income that we can tap into, and I was wondering if you're pursuing other avenues for that. Maybe I know that in the past year or so, there's been a real resurgence in, for the lack of a better term, which was actually a historical term, sheet music, where they, you know, people can download your sheet music, which is a value to us as indies as a copyright.
If you're asking if CD Baby is going into that kind of stuff, no. It's funny, ever since, actually, do you guys know the comedian Mitch Hedberg? Do you ever hear him? He had a really funny delivery style where he'd kind of say, ducks are only interested in me. Ducks' opinion of me is greatly influenced on whether or not I have bread.
Oh.
And one of the things that he said was,
I recognize that voice and that style. Yeah, I have heard
him. He was great, man. So, one of his jokes was, I guess he was just like some guy from the Midwest that started getting really well known as a stand-up comic, and people said, oh, man, you should go out to L.A. So he went out to L.A., and apparently everybody was trying to convince him to go into, you know, writing for movies or whatever. He said, man, it's kind of a drag when you're I'm a stand-up comedian, man, and everybody says, hey, you're a good stand-up comic. Do you write? And I'd say, hey, man, that's not fair. You don't go to a restaurant that you really like and go to the chef and say, hey, you're a really good chef. Do you farm? ever since I started CD Baby, it's really flattering. Sometimes people will say things like, hey, CD Baby's really cool. You should start a radio station. You should start a booking agency. You should start a whatever. And I think, God, you know, it's really a lot of work just trying to be a really good record store, distributor, sales and distribution. It's kind of all I can do just to try to keep up with that. So I don't have any real plans to start a kind of new thing that would like help people get into sheet music or other stuff, but directly. But then I think, on the other hand, our digital distribution system has grown way beyond what I ever thought it would be. You know, for those of you that don't know, CD Baby is one of those companies that can get your music selling up on Apple iTunes and Napster and Rhapsody and Yahoo Music and eMusic and all of those places. But the way it started, I didn't even think about it. It was just that right before the iTunes Music Store launched, we get a call from Apple saying, please come to our office next Thursday, 1 o'clock. Okay. When Apple says do something, you say okay. So went to this like private meeting there with just a few dozen people, and then Steve Jobs himself walks out, and he's kind of telling us about the iTunes Music Store, and he says, we want to have every piece of music ever recorded available for sale in the iTunes Music Store. So we want your whole catalog. And their whole thing was like, they're a computer hardware manufacturing company. They can't deal directly with having thousands of musicians calling them up. So they needed a company like CD Baby to act as a single client that brings them thousands of albums. So all we really had to do was say, okay, and start our digital distribution service. And I really honestly kind of thought it would stop there. But what's interesting, this is kind of a long way of answering your question as a yes, is that since we did that, all kinds of new business plans have come out of the woodworks. People that want our catalog, our entire CD Baby catalog, meaning, you know, all of your music, so that they can use it as streaming background music playing behind blogs that pays you a couple cents per person listening, or people that want it so that you can legally share it between friends, but the third friend who listens to it has to pay, but the first two get it for free, encouraging them to spread it on because then they get a cut of the third person who sells it. All these really interesting business plans have come out of digital distribution. So I think that's kind of a long way of saying yes to your question. It may not be sheet music, but there are all kinds of really weird, interesting ways that people are finding to make money for musicians for the use, not necessarily the sale, but the use of their music in things, including, you know, subscription services like Rhapsody, which if you guys haven't tried Rhapsody yet, you should definitely try it. I mean, it's worth it. $20 just in the name of experimenting, to be able to pull up and listen to any piece of music ever recorded and have it, it's already paid for because you're just paying a subscription service. You're now legally allowed to listen to anything anytime you want to hear it. And all of these kind of things are coming out of the woodworks that are finding new ways to generate money for your songs that you've written, for your copyrights, through ways that you've never even thought of before.
Even independent, there are a number of independent artists that are, like, especially piano players. Like, I think you know David Neveu from Portland, mm-hmm. who wrote that book on internet music marketing. Lori Lines, an artist from Minneapolis, who's done, I think she's like one of the largest woman-owned indie record labels in the world, perhaps, or at least in the country, in Minneapolis. And but anyway, they both sell sheet music from their websites. It's an income stream for them. So you don't really have to hook up with an aggregator or another company if you've got a fan base and people asking you for sheet music. I mean, that's another thing, is just keep your ears open for what your fans, what people are asking you for. If enough of them are asking, there's probably a bigger demand out there. Try find a way to offer it, right?
Well, it's becoming more and more popular because you have bigger conglomerates like Clear Channel that is buying out the aggregators like Grassnets. Selling the lyrics based on the revolution of the digital revolution of like HD radio and tagging, where the next venture is you're going to be riding down the road listening to your favorite song and say, oh, I wonder what the lyric is, and you hit a button and it pops, it sends the lyrics to your email. So I think it's going to be an interesting commodity coming as we as indies that, you know, we own our lyrics. And as we all know in the history of music, I mean, that's where it started out, is sheet music.
Yep.
Yeah.
That was the first business of music, I think. The 1800s, right?
What goes around comes around, I guess.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for the question from Nashville. I appreciate it. I know we're getting up in an hour and a half here, so we're going to have to wrap this up. I'll give, if someone wants to do one more question real quick, pop in, especially if you're
in Indy.
Who's this?
This is James in Indianapolis.
Hey, James. Welcome. What's your question?
Okay, I'm wondering, is the relationship with CD Baby and iTunes and Rhapsody and the digital distribution getting closer to the point where you'll be able to predict your date that it will be available on those services so that you can coordinate your marketing any better?
I wish. It's funny, man. You know, sometimes it's predictable. Sometimes iTunes will be lightning fast. They will, you know, we'll send them something on Tuesday and it's up on Thursday. And it'll go like that for a couple months. And then they'll have just some kind of like internal whatever, and all of a sudden we send it to them on Tuesday and it is available a month later. So it's really all on their end. It's tough. And, you know, everything we do on our side is just kind of, we aim to just turn it around and code it as quick as possible and get it out to them. And we have good relationships with them. You know, we visit them every month. They generally, all the companies we distribute it to are fans of CD Baby. And you know, it's kind of cute, by the way, a lot of employees of Apple and eMusic and Rhapsody are musicians themselves, and they use CD Baby to get their music onto Apple. So it's kind of cool when we go visit their office, and, you know, even their employees are like, hey, I'm a CD Baby client. So I don't know. They're doing the best they can, but it's still just unpredictable. I'm sorry.
Cool. Hey, Derek, I'm going to mute everyone here real quick.
So, presentation mode is on. Only organizers can be heard.
And yeah, I'm going to wrap this up because I know you've been very generous with your time here. I just wanted to ask you real quick. This is just something that popped in my head, but are any thoughts on this new MySpace music thing that's supposedly coming up, or any involvement with CD Baby there? Or?
I don't even know if you know this little odd fact about me. I've never been to MySpace. I've heard about it. I went once and it crashed my browser, and I just never went back. There's some things that just some trends just pass you by. I was busy when it came out. Now I hear it's kind of in decline. I don't know. I've never been to MySpace, so I don't have any opinion.
But I mean,
that.
Well, yeah, I didn't mean MySpace music in the generic sense, but there's a collaboration that was between MySpace and like three of the four major labels are going to launch this new, like, they're supposed to rival iTunes. They're supposed to be able to buy downloads and all that. And so I didn't know if you'd I guess if you haven't heard about
No, I mean, I saw the little press release about it, but again, okay. it said MySpace, and I just shrugged. And but, you know, in general, I never believe any of the supposed to stuff.
Right, till it happens, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, tell me when it's the biggest or whatever, when it looks like a serious contender or it's actually out and thousands of your fans are buying music there, then, you know, then let's talk about it. But it's believing the press releases and all that, I just kind of ignore it.
Right, cool. Okay. Yeah, like a lot of people are, yeah, I did a blog post where a lot of people were, you know, shouting Chicken Little, the sky is falling, because if anything dealing with corporations was evil, and, you know, I was telling people just to kind of chill out and wait and see what happens for you.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
predict
yeah.
the demise of the indie, I don't know. But real quickly, I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have any kind of a foreshadowing of what you might be covering at the boot camp event in June?
No.
Okay.
Well, you know what? Actually, okay, anybody who's here listening that is going to be at the event, check out my blog at sivers.org. It's my last name, spelled SIVERS.org. Or honestly, you could just Google my name, Derek Sivers, and it's the first result. The reason is because I've been writing a lot of articles and essays there lately that are really kind of written for musicians, things that I think are, you know, the kind of stuff that we talked about today. And if you get the chance to read some of those before the event in June, then when you get there, you know, feel free. I'm going to be there for the entire, whatever, from start to finish of the event. So to me, it's not just about the whatever hour or two that I might be on stage talking, but I'm going to be hanging out before and after and glad to talk to anybody. So if you guys have any questions about that stuff or you want to talk about stuff that I've already written and talked about and we can talk about it deeper, that could lead to some better conversations.
Cool.
So other than that, man, I'm going to hold nothing back. I'm going to try to talk about every last single bit of advice I can possibly think of to give at your event and get everybody their money's worth for coming.
Cool. When I know Robin asked about Taxi earlier, and I went for the first time to the Taxi Road Rally, and I've actually known Michael Lasko, who is the CEO of Taxi. Actually, my relationship with him predates ours. I've known him since about 92 or 93 or something. And, yeah, he's a genuine guy. But I like what he does, what he did at the role that he played. He was kind of like the MC, and also for people that are old enough to remember the TV show Donahue, remember how he used to run around the audience with a microphone and, you know,
yeah.
Is the caller there and all that. I'm going to play a little bit of that role where at the end of everyone's solo presentation, I'm going to pipe in and probably ask some initial questions and interact with each speaker and then run around the room and get people in the audience to, you know, like I said, make it fun and interactive. So I'm really looking
Good.
Forward to that. But again, it's the Indie Buzz Bootcamp event that we're talking about, and the website is just that, Indie Buzz Bootcamp, and Indie is spelled INDIE. buzzbootcamp.com. It's June 20th to the 22nd. It's the third weekend in June in St. Louis, Missouri, which is centrally located. And, you know, we got people coming from all over the U.S., both coasts. Actually, there's far more people coming from outside of St. Louis than are coming from the immediate area. I've even got people coming from France and the U.K. So it's going to be a pretty cool group of people there. And I'm just really looking forward to the energy that's going to be in the room. But there's 25% off the enrollment if you go to that indiebuzzbootcamp.com site. And a real cool deal if you want to bring a friend, a special price to get two people in. And I'm offering something that I don't even know if it's offered at most music conferences, but it's a 100% money-back guarantee if you stay all 3 days. At the end of it, you don't think it was worth it, just tell one of me or one of my staff, and we will make arrangements to give you every penny of your money back. So I'm going to, you know, live up to my promises here. So, other speakers there, Ariel Hyatt. He's a friend of you know Ariel. She's going to be talking about Web 2.0 stuff and a little bit about music publicity. And I know I think the world of her, and I assume that you do too, Derek.
Yeah.
A performance coach, Tom Jackson from Nashville. If you've ever seen him, you'll never think of live performance again after you see Tom do his thing. Nancy Moran, John Taglieri, our friend Riley Madison is going to be hosting a Behind the Song cafe, and a songwriter named Will Nance, who's got a number of hits out, is also going to be performing, and he'll be available to talk to people about writing songs that reach a lot of people. I'm not sure how much it'll be hitting those edges that you talk about, but I think everybody can learn actually from you know, songwriting craft.
Oh, absolutely.
Tailored to your own style. And I want to thank my girlfriend Pookie, who is playing a big role in helping me organize this event. So thanks to everyone who called, and Derek, especially thank you so much for taking what's like 90 minutes now to chat with me and everyone who's listening.
Yeah, it's fun. I like it. And, you know, seriously, feel free to, anybody on my website, feel free to drop me an email if you have any questions. I'm very glad to help.
Very, very cool. I look forward to seeing you in person in about a month or so from now. So have fun in the meantime, and I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Bob.
All right. Good night, everybody. Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone.